Obviously, oil tax reform is number one, and I think the governor led us in the wrong direction.
A Democrat considers jumping into the 2014 race for governor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking for answers about the dinosaurs that used to populate Denali National Park.
We're demonstrating that dinosaurs didn't just live in the high latitudes some 70 million years ago. They were thriving back then.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years, from executive and technical placement to medical in-office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com.
The Alaska Democratic Party may finally have at least one candidate in the race for governor. Hollis French, a state senator from Anchorage, announced today he's considering jumping in. French filed a letter of intent with the Division of Elections yesterday. He says while he's leaning strongly toward a run, he wants to wait to see how much money he can raise and if a campaign would be viable. He's also using time to develop his platform.
Obviously, oil tax reform is number one. It's the single most important issue confronting the economic future of the state, and I think the governor led us in the wrong direction.
If French does decide to run, that would make it at least a three-way race for governor. Incumbent Sean Parnell has already registered as a candidate, and so has Bill Walker, a Republican turned independent. To make things more complicated, there's an effort to draft Bill Willikowski, a Democratic state senator, to join the independent ticket in the lieutenant governor slot. French says he hasn't spoken to Willikowski about his intentions and that he hopes a three-way race could actually split in his favor.
Having Bill Walker jump in as a third party, you know, I think made it far more likely that a Democrat can get elected. The last time a Democrat was elected who wasn't not an incumbent was 1994. That was Tony Knowles, essentially in a three-way race.
French has served in the state legislature since 2003 and says he will defend his Senate seat if he decides against running for governor. If he does launch a campaign, it will be his second gubernatorial race. In 2010, he lost to Ethan Berkowitz in the Democratic primary. A new lawsuit has been filed against the state redistricting board. This time, it's the Alaska Democratic Party. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
In a couple of ways, the redistricting process is sort of like solving a Rubik's Cube. It can be really frustrating, and every time you try to fix a part, you run the risk of messing up something else. From the perspective of the Alaska Democratic Party, the map used for the last election was
outrageous.
But the newest version?
This one is just bad.
Joe McKinnon is the party's attorney. He says that while the redistricting board's newest map solves some constitutional problems, it creates a few others. That's why the party, along with Katie Hurley and Warren Keough, filed a lawsuit against the board on Tuesday. There's already another group based in Fairbanks that's suing the board for different reasons concerning the Senate pairings of certain districts, and it's possible this new lawsuit could be rolled into that one. McKinnon says his clients have a handful of concerns with the new map. They think the board, which is mostly made up of Republicans, took extra voters from the conservative Matsu region to make other seats more secure for their party.
The Matsu has exactly enough population for five seats, and yet the board only put four seats within the borough and then split the other population, putting part in with Valdez and part in with Anchorage.
McKinnon says the way the lines were drawn in the Kenai Peninsula and in Fairbanks are similarly problematic. He also says the state's rural districts should have been better drawn to match Native corporation boundaries. Now, McKinnon wants the courts to say the redistricting board has had enough chances to produce a constitutional map.
The remedy we want is for the court to draw the final map, to appoint a master.
The redistricting process started 3 years ago, and the courts are hearing the lawsuits on an expedited basis in an effort to finalize the state's political boundaries before the 2014 election. McKinnon says he's hoping for a decision from the Superior Court by this fall, but that no matter the outcome, the case could then end up before the Alaska Supreme Court on appeal. Neither the redistricting board's chair nor its attorney returned calls for an interview about this lawsuit, but they have previously defended the constitutionality of their maps and have asked for other litigation against them to be dismissed. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The dinosaur hunters are back from this year's field season in Denali National Park. Composed of researchers from Fairbanks, Japan, Korea, and Texas, the team took a helicopter into wilderness into the Riley Creek area to look for footprints laid down 70 million years ago. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
It's been about 30 years since University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Roland Gangloff took a serious look at some tracks found during oil exploration on the North Slope and realized they were made by dinosaurs. Then in 2005, they began finding dinosaur tracks in Denali. Now retired, Professor Gangloff published his book, Dinosaurs Under the Aurora, last year, describing polar dinosaurs, creatures that walked the north near the end of the Cretaceous Age, when temperatures above the Arctic Circle were about like the northern border of the lower 48 now. Also last year, the Perot Museum in Dallas assembled an exhibit hall that includes footprints, the assembled skeletons of three Alaska dinosaurs, and begins to tell their story. Museum curator Anthony Fiorillo has been filling that story out with yearly trips to Alaska for the last 15 years, and they just keep finding more footprints.
We do answer some questions, but then we raise so many more. And out of the work we did in Denali this year, we have made some new discoveries of some animals we hadn't recognized here in Denali before. And it's actually was stunning to us because in some places those discoveries were places we have tromped year after year.
You might not see footprints as exactly dinosaurs' most exciting features, but you might not be Tony Fiorillo. He can tell from a footprint whether a dinosaur is a meat eater or a vegetarian, and even if it's a meat eater that switched.
As a paleontologist, you study a lot of anatomy. And if you know the anatomy of feet, you know, of the skeleton, then you could reasonably interpret a footprint.
There are so many footprints now being found that it's proving there were an awful lot of dinosaurs in the north.
We're demonstrating that dinosaurs didn't just live in the high latitudes some 70 million years ago. They were thriving back then. There were big populations of big herbivores and lots of biodiversity and just some really interesting ecosystem dynamics here.
There were duck-billed dinosaurs, bipedal dinosaurs, dinosaurs with feathers, and dinosaurs that were brightly colored. If you're thinking that seems an awful lot like birds, you're thinking like Fiorillo.
Most of us consider birds to be dinosaurs, and just like birds today communicate with color, we presume that dinosaurs did the same.
So it's a whole Cretaceous ecosystem they're puzzling out here, very near the end of the time of the dinosaurs, and there are large and small ones, a dinosaur food chain, and large abundances of dinosaurs and their descendants, the birds.
Denali's got the best record for fossil footprints of birds anywhere on the planet.
Birds had been evolving from dinosaurs for tens of millions of years by the time of the Denali fossils. Fiorillo says he's been studying them so long, and they're so abundant, that he's beginning to develop a sense for their ancient habitats, 70 million years back in deep time.
Just like you don't see animals spread out in one uniform layer across the landscape today, you know, they're broken out into separate habitats. We think we're starting to see that with some of these dinosaur remains, some of these footprints. They're telling us there's patterns that are repeatable enough that we're confident to make a prediction that when we see a certain type of rock out on the other side of the valley, we say, you know, if we go over there, we'll find dinosaur X, Y, or Z. And we're starting to have that level of prediction, and so that's been pretty fun.
Lugging mold-making equipment, GPSs, measuring and image processing equipment up steep slopes that may or may not contain dinosaur tracks might not be everyone's definition of fun. But now, with the field work over, comes the interpretation part. Fiorillo says he returns from every trip with orders to make some changes in the exhibitions. It's not just the feathers, the color, and the diversity. It's now subtler and deeper questions about habitat use and how intelligent these creatures were. The dinosaur hunt goes on, and he likes it that way.
As long as I've remembered, there were only two things I ever wanted to do in life. One was dig up dinosaurs, and the other was play center field for the New York Yankees. And much to the detriment of my parents' retirement plans, I chose to do what I do. So yes, I think I've been wanting to do this forever.
The Park Service considers the fossil tracks to be archaeological resources, and locations are closely documented. Public access at some time in the future is not out of the question. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating renewable energy at a fair in Anchorage.
Alaska's got 90% of all the country's tidal power potential and 50% of all of the country's wave power potential. So if anyone's going to be a leader, it should be Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A Coast Guard helicopter is flying over the sites of two sinkings in southeast Alaska today to check for pollution. The 75-foot tender Pacific Queen, homeported out of Wrangell, took on water and sank south of Petersburg early this morning. 1,000 gallons of fuel were reported on board. Later, the 56-foot Saner Coral Sea ran aground and was partially submerged off Gord Island. That's a small island in southern southeast Alaska. 500 gallons of fuel was reported on board. The Coast Guard says the Coral Sea is owned by a Sitka fisherman. The Pacific Queen's three crew members were picked up by the fishing vessel Windham Bay, while the Coral Sea's five crew members were picked up by the fishing vessel Time Bandit. The Time Bandit is the same one frequently seen on the Deadliest Catch television show. No injuries were reported among any of the eight rescued crew members. Crews have been very cautious in salvaging a fishing tender that grounded near Valdez last weekend. According to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the Fate Hunter is currently lying on a rock ledge as divers assess the vessel. DEC State On-Scene Coordinator John Engels says there's been some sheen spotted from the bilge slots, but none from the vessel itself.
The fuel vents have been capped and they're still intact. So as long as we don't have a major problem with the pollution going on, we'll let them take their time and safely go about righting the vessel so that we can lighter the fuel off of it and then look into raising it up again.
Engel says there isn't a timeline as to when the Fate Hunter will be raised. The 65-foot vessel grounded in Shoup Bay, 4 miles west of Valdez, on Sunday morning. The four-person crew was safely transported back to Valdez by the Good Samaritan vessel, Akimi. No injuries were reported. Wildfires have been a major problem throughout Alaska this summer. Southeast is known for its ever-present rain and chilly weather, but now even the rainforest is hot and dry. Wrangell has been under a burn ban for the last week, and the town is still waiting for rain. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has this update.
This unusually warm and sunny weather is the talk of the town this season. Christy Jamison was born and raised in Wrangell. She says she hasn't seen a summer like this since she was a kid.
I've talked about this with some close friends who live down south in the lower 48 and also here, and we all agree that we haven't had a summer like this in years and years and years.
No, it's probably right up in there in the top five as far as the driest season that I've seen.
That's Fire Chief Tim Buness. The burn ban covers all outdoor fires. That includes burn barrels, wood in fire pits, and trash or cardboard piles. Dorianne Blatchley is the administrator at the fire department. She says that even the most run-of-the-mill burn pile can mean trouble in this weather.
Just because it's been so dry, we're just asking that everybody hold off until we get a good heavy rain.
Chief Buness says one bout of rain may not even be enough. The ground has to be saturated and be able to stay damp before the fire department will lift the ban.
It's going to pretty well soak it up here for the first go around or two.
Apart from the fire danger, these dry conditions are tough on residents who live off the city's water system. Many rely on rainfall catchment systems for water to use in showers, toilets, and sinks. They're watching tank levels get lower and lower with no clouds on the horizon. It's a catch-22. Southeast residents love the sunny weather while it's here, but many are now hoping the rain comes back soon, if just for a little while. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Industry leaders predict melting sea ice will bring new opportunities in oil and gas development, maritime shipping, and infrastructure development. But at an Institute of the North panel, educators and employers alike predicted a shortage of Alaskans who are prepared to take the jobs. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich kicked off the panel on workforce development by telling an audience of about 50 people Alaskans need to prepare and plan ahead to get their share of the thousands of jobs predicted to open up in coming decades. Those plans need to reach deeply into the educational system, according to panelist and engineering professor Herb Schroeder, vice provost and founder of the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP, at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Through ANSEP, middle school and high school students get a taste of college life and take college-level courses in subjects that might not be available at local schools. Without that help, Schroeder says many Alaskan students who got good grades in high school get a shocking wake-up call when they start college.
They've actually been set up for failure. Because in order for a kid to come here to our university and be successful in science or engineering, they have to meet some fundamental academic requirements, and that is successful completion of chemistry, physics, and trigonometry. And most of the kids, almost all of the students that come from schools outside of Anchorage and Fairbanks don't meet those criteria, even though many of them have those courses completed in their schools.
Sam Hill is Vice President of Human Resources at the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation's Energy Services. He says Alaskans have experience and local knowledge employers appreciate. He says to keep all their options open until they choose a career, young people need a broad education, including how Native corporations came into being and the past and projected future of oil and gas development. He says seeing the big picture helps young people see the range of opportunities available.
It keeps people in Alaska and it keeps people filling those jobs so that people, not that we don't want them, but people from the outside coming in to take some of those, which we're seeing a lot of right now. You know, we're seeing a lot of companies from the lower 48 moving up here to take over some of the contracts that we should be, you know, servicing ourselves.
Florian Borowski is Human Resources Director of CH2M Hill and the Vice Chair of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. He says young people need to understand the effects poor choices in five areas will have on their ability to get good jobs.
Things like they don't have a high school diploma or a GED. They can't pass our drug and alcohol test. They have issues with their motor vehicle record. There's issues of criminal background, felony convictions or multiple misdemeanors. And then ultimately we've added a new component, what we call fitness for duty. Folks have to be able to physically, safely perform the essential functions of the job without putting themselves at risk.
Borowski says a surprising number of job applicants don't get hired because of those five issues.
What we found is that anywhere from 30 to 50% sometimes of the job applicants that we offer jobs to can't pass all of those together to ultimately come to work. And it's really disappointing.
The Institute of the North's Week of the Arctic continues through Sunday with sessions on topics such as oil spill response, search and rescue, and architecture for the Arctic. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to pirates? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy exhibits like the Cavallo Equestrian Arts, the Keith King BMX Stunt Show, Brad's World Reptiles, and with wonderful things from King Tut's tomb. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, exhibits, and fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
The Anchorage School District says it has reached a tentative agreement with the Anchorage Education Association on a 3-year labor contract through June 2016. The old contract expired on June 30th. Teachers would receive a $1,500 bonus in years 1 and 3. The proposal includes a 1% pay increase each year, plus step increases for longevity or additional education. However, teachers on a plan for improvement would not be eligible for step movements or increases for educational attainment. Denali State Park will be adding new facilities as part of a 2-phase project that is planned to culminate in a new South Denali Visitor Center. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
The groundbreaking ceremony for the first phase of the South Denali Visitor Center project will be held on Friday. Phase 1 does not include the development of the actual visitor center, but does include other recreational facilities, as David Griffin, a natural resource specialist with the state park, explains.
Phase 1 includes the construction of a 1.5-mile long access road, a 22-stall day-use parking / trailhead, a 1-mile interpretive trail, which will have interpretive components, different panels, talking about the natural history of the area. There's going to be a 32-space campground with electrical hookups. There's going to be a 15-site walk-in tent camping area. And then there will be several miles of new trail developed in the vicinity.
The first phase will also include a ranger station and maintenance facilities. Griffin says it is designed to provide a base of operations for state park staff throughout the visitor center development. The second phase is still being planned and involves more extensive construction and development.
If we receive full funding for the project, then we would move on to phase 2, which would include development of an access road up to a site just below Curry Ridge, and then the construction of a visitor center. A world-class facility that would have interpretive components, multi-use facilities, incredible viewing opportunities both indoor and outside the facility, interpretive trails around the lake, and then trails that would connect up to Curry Ridge, maybe take some hikers past the historic Curry Lookout, and then ideally would connect over to the Kasugi Ridge Trail System.
Griffin says that the state hopes to have the campground open in late 2014 or early 2015, depending on the weather. Ground clearing has begun, and the electrical grid is being expanded north along the park's highway in connection with the project. The groundbreaking will be attended by a number of state legislators, as well as Matsu Borough Manager John Moosey, Denali National Park Superintendent Don Stryker, and representatives from United Companies, Inc., the Hooper Bay Village Corporation subsidiary that donated 104 acres of land to the project. The ceremony will be held at mile 135 of the park's highway and begins at 11 a.m. on Friday. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Tidal power, wave, wind, and solar. There's no lack of options when it comes to renewable energy in Alaska. For participants at the Alaska Renewable Energy Fair on the Anchorage Park Strip last weekend, Alaska may be one of the best places on the planet to develop some of these ideas. APRN's Sarah Bernard reports.
Renewable energy isn't just about wind turbines and solar panels and biodiesel. It's also, according to the Renewable Energy Alaska Project's executive director, Chris Rose, about economics.
State of Alaska, cumulatively, all of us, we're spending about $6 billion a year on energy. We have some of the highest energy costs in the country. So one of the advantages Alaska has in some ways is that we've got such high energy prices that we're a great place to put in some of these emerging technologies like tidal and wave because we can save people money almost immediately.
Rose says the Alaska Renewable Energy Fair, which will celebrate its 10th anniversary next year, is a way to get people to think about all that. About energy consumption and energy costs, no matter the source.
The event is an opportunity for Alaskans to come and learn about energy. It's not just renewable energy, but where does energy come from? Implications of all our energy systems and our choices. And of course, we really focus a lot on renewable energy and energy efficiency. That's what we're promoting and educating people about. But really, we're trying to give people context for all the energy decisions that they make.
Energy efficiency is one of the things that Chugach Electric has in mind for its customers. Kate McEwen is the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Specialist with Chugach. She says they've launched several online tools and a Facebook app that lets people measure their energy use and access information about how to reduce that use at home.
Renewables are fun. You see that wind turbine, you see that solar panel, but energy efficiency, it's a little bit behind the scenes. And so we're trying to let people know that they could save money, which is very important, by doing very simple tips.
Tips as simple as using fluorescent light bulbs, or cleaning out the dryer vent, or putting in windows with better insulation. People can also convert to using vegetable oil or biodiesel in their cars pretty easily, says Arctic VegWorks founder Will Tagan. Tagan teaches workshops around town as well as a class at Matsu College.
Biodiesel can be run in any vehicle with no modifications, no heating. You just need to chemically process the fuel to thin it out.
And for Tagan's car, a slight modification to the diesel engine means he can drive it on vegetable oil, straight from the deep fryer.
This is a 1982 diesel Volkswagen Campmobile, and it has been running on pure vegetable oil all over the state all summer for fishing and hunting and playing.
Tagan led a workshop on how to make biodiesel at Saturday's event, along with many other workshops and updates on local energy projects. The Anchorage Landfill Gas to Energy Project, for instance, uses methane from the Anchorage landfill to produce 5.6 megawatts of power for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, or about 25% of the base's electricity.
The blue area that you can see on the map is where we're actively collecting gas out of the trash.
And Chris Rose says the tidal energy projects being explored right now in the Cook Inlet could be some of the most promising developments in Alaska.
Alaska's got 90% of all the country's tidal power potential and 50% of all of the country's wave power potential. So if anyone's going to be a leader, it should be Alaska.
There is a lot of potential, and combining lots of energy sources, from fossil fuels to vegetable fuels, is one way to bring costs down and keep energy up. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Bernard.
Thank you, folks. Thanks for dancing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Sarah Bernard and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit, our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at SalmonLove.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.